Senate Judiciary Committee, April 1st, 1991.
Okay, let's, committee will come to order, and we will, Springer has been here, I think we just went around the corner. We have Senator Hanby, I think, is excused today. Brockman will be here shortly, Springer's here. Let's then continue on with our contempt Senate Bill 376, and I've sort of, as we sort of finished our discussion last week, the thought occurred to me that we may or may not, as a committee, have lost sight of the purpose of contempt. So I've asked Judge Lipscomb to come up and just give us the judge's point of view about what it means and what the purpose is. It's a little bit different than sort of remind us what this is all about. And I really thank you for being willing to take time away from your docket. And
that's okay, and I'm grateful for you to call me first, as I have a jury I need to get back to, and I apologize in advance for leaving after my testimony and after any questions that you might have. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Lipscomb. I'm a district court judge here in Marion County in Salem. And I was asked to come here, I think at the chair's request and also at the request of the Judicial Department, to speak briefly, as I understand my assignment, of what role contempt plays in our business as judicial officers of the state. The contempt power is an important power of the court. It basically is what gives us an ability to enforce and gives the state, the system, an ability to enforce our judgments, orders, and decrees. Without the power of contempt, there's no teeth in what we do, basically, at least outside the criminal law itself, violations of statute. Because there you have the state acting as the enforcement mechanism. But in civil cases, divorce cases, any other case where the powers of the court are called to bear under the statutes or the common law of this jurisdiction, there's no enforcement mechanism set up to enforce the orders of the court other than the contempt power. And for that reason, the contempt power has been recognized from the earliest days when courts and judicial officers were created. It was recognized that there had to be a means to enforce the order of the court, and not only its orders, but also the authority of the court in exercising its jurisdiction and judgment. And that really is the principal basis for the contempt power and where the principal need arises. The problem, the reason that you have before you a bill, is that the contempt power in this state is ill-defined and not clearly set forth anywhere so that practitioners and litigants have a handy tool for understanding it and for calling it into play and for expediting its use in an appropriate fashion when the time and place calls for it. It's been a couple of years that we've been working on this problem and trying to address the confusion that currently exists and rectifying that so that the contempt power becomes a more useful tool for litigants and for the court. The bill before you, Senate Bill 376, does help clear up this confusion and fills in some of the procedural gaps that have plagued courts and practitioners. Senate Bill 376 does not seek to expand existing contempt powers of the court. This is not a big power grab on the part of anybody. What we've tried to do in drafting this over the last couple of years is to reflect the state of the law as it exists and to improve its ability to be utilized in the court. We've met with as many concerned agencies, individuals, and groups as we could in putting this together and taking their input. And the reason for that was to bring them up to speed early on and to get their input, and also to make sure that we weren't inadvertently favoring one group or one side or another. I think what the product of all that has been what I would view as a very helpful roadmap for the future as to how the contempt can be used to assist litigants and practitioners in utilizing the contempt power to avoid problems, to avoid unnecessary appeals, and to avoid uncertainty. It should make it less expensive to use. It should make it easier to use. But I would respectfully suggest to you that it's not likely to make it more frequently invoked. This is not going to be a panacea or a substitute for ordinary procedures. It's simply going to standardize contempt, standardize the way we do it, and make access to it less haphazard. That's basically what I had to say, and unless you folks want me to address specific aspects of the existing bill, I haven't had an opportunity to participate in what's happened over the last several weeks in terms of amendments to the bill, but I'm now familiar with it. I took time over the lunch hour to get up to speed on at least what I think is the most current and engrossed version of that. So if I have anybody has any questions, I'll do my best to respond.
Thank you. Other questions of the judge? Senator Hill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Paul, one of the things that we did in our last work session, I believe we made the burden of proof for both remedial and punitive beyond a reasonable doubt. And the concern was that when you were talking about incarcerating someone, that the standard should be reasonable doubt, because just as any criminal proceeding where someone was going to be incarcerated. Now, there is a possibility, at least, something that has been discussed, is leaving the standard to be clear and convincing for things that do not, sanctions that do not involve incarceration.
Where incarceration is not a potential.
Yes. Now, is that an important distinction to be made, given that things are going to remain the same as far as, beyond a reasonable doubt, as far as incarceration is concerned?
I think people who don't work with the two standards of proof might not readily understand how difficult it is to establish something beyond a reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt means to a moral certainty. Now, that's part of the definition of reasonable doubt that we use in instructing juries. It's the kind of proof that an individual would be willing to act upon in the very most important of their own affairs. It's a very, very high standard of proof. And proof beyond a reasonable doubt means that. Beyond all reasonable doubts. That's very hard to meet. I would suggest that you not at least that you not lightly assume that standard of proof for all contempts. There are good reasons that standard of proof is confined to the kinds of issues where you are contemplating putting someone in some kind of penal confinement. It certainly would not destroy the contempt power to have that standard of proof imposed, but it would interfere with its effectiveness, I would submit. It will also make the proceedings more lengthy and expensive, even where incarceration is not at issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further questions of the judge?
Thank you all.
We appreciate it. Okay, let's then turn it back.
did you want to deal with that?
Well, we can. Senator, we do. Senator Hill, are you interested in moving or talking more about it? We're willing to do. Let's go ahead and get it.
Well, Manager, we have talked about it, and Senator Bunn's concern, I think, was primarily being sure that we have a standard beyond a reasonable doubt where incarceration was involved. And I guess my intent would be to leave that as we changed it, but I would, as far where incarceration was not involved, that the standard would be clear and convincing.
Senator Bunn, do you have comments about that?
Madam Chair, although I prefer more difficult, I have no problem with changing. I think it'll be page 3, line 16. Mm-hmm. On that, the sub 12, I think we would add another that would become 13, so that we would leave 12, proof of contempt shall be by clear and convincing evidence. And then proof of contempt shall be beyond a reasonable doubt if incarceration is a possibility. So that we would add a qualifier for that.
Ingrid, we have something that approximates that, but it's backwards from what you said.
That
takes off on where we. I guess we could do it either way. We didn't change what the committee did last time. But we're just adding another subsection that lowers it.
The amendments that we discussed last time. Because I don't see any of the amendments.
That's what you're saying.
It leaves the amendment that we made intact and adds another section.
Is it okay, Senator Bunn?
That's fine.
Okay.
Senator, are we in a work session then?
Yes. This is all work session.
Oh, okay. Yes. Then I would move the SB 76-10 amendments dated 3/28/91.
Are there objections to Senator Hill's motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you very much. Okay, we have one other little visitation to make based on what we did last time, and that would be the willful issue. We had a contact from the Attorney General who took the Cooey case up to the court, and I think we've invited him here to come, Mr. Adams. So he's going to give us his pitch on how he thinks we made a judgment in error or by including both words on as a definition of contempt. And so I think maybe right. So let's talk about the willful. And we added willfully. Something about bad intent here. I didn't see. I can't.
It was line 9, Madam Chair. Was
right. With following acts taken with bad intent or something.
Taken willfully.
But okay, let's hear your recommendations for us, having been through this court case and in the process of appealing it. I guess right.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Senators, my name is Jazz Adams, and I'm in the Appellate Division of the Attorney General's Office. And I did handle the Badger State XL Badger versus Cooey case, which we're petitioning for review on. And basically, the bottom line is I think the original language of the bill, by using the word willful, summarizes Supreme Court precedent, which ought to be the precedent that counts. And if the intent of the committee is to codify the existing case law on contempt, the word willful does that. And I can trace for the committee the progress of the law, basically, if the committee is interested. But essentially, if we go back to the 30s, there are several cases in the 30s that describe the intent element for contempt in terms of just willful. And one of those cases, which is a key case from the Oregon Supreme Court, is the Grover case. And in that case, the Oregon Supreme Court cited the United States Supreme Court in defining what willful means. And willful means, according to Grover and the U.S. Supreme Court, knowingly plus bad intent. So willful already incorporates in it the element of bad intent. And every case since Grover, which is a 1938 Oregon Supreme Court decision, has cited Grover. And every Supreme Court, Oregon Supreme Court case since then has basically, in citing Grover and the subsequent cases, has continued that thought. Now, a couple of the cases have picked up the phrase willfully and with bad intent. But until the Court of Appeals a couple of years ago started to separate out those elements as if they were separate, no Oregon Supreme Court case had ever said that those were anything different. And in fact, in Grover, the court said that the two actually are equivalent. In other words, bad intent is already included in willful. So I think what the Court of Appeals has done in the last couple of years, it's kind of like if you have a phrase like arbitrary and capricious or clear and convincing. And again, the phrase willfully and with bad intent was only in the case law. There was never any statute with that. Sometimes it's a tendency to take a dual phrase like that that really just means one thing and separate it out as if it's two different things. And that's what the Court of Appeals did in this case, Badger versus Cooey. It is not the last word in Oregon law. We petitioned for review. We hope the Supreme Court will accept review and basically adjust the Court of Appeals opinion in accordance with the previous Supreme Court precedent, which is a standard as willful. And I have some policy reasons why that also makes sense if you think about what contempt really is. Just a second, what Judge Lipscomb said. Contempt really is the equitable power of a court to enforce its own orders. It's the only way the court has of, as a third branch of government, of doing anything. In other words, it's what puts teeth into what the court does. Think about some of the settings in which contempt arises. A witness refuses to answer, even though the testimony would not be incriminated. They just flat out refuse for personal reasons of their own. The mere fact that they're disobeying the court orders to testify is willful disobedience of the order. No extra special bad intent or subjective intent should be required. Or look at, for example, child support. Somebody knows they have an outstanding child support obligation of several thousand dollars. They have some ability to pay that. And yet they, knowing of this obligation and knowing that they're ordered to comply with it, they deliberately fail to do so. No special bad intent in Oregon law has ever been required. You know, you don't have to be found guilty of contempt or determined a contempt determination made, there's really no necessary finding that you had a motive of revenge or some malicious intent to spite the ex-wife or anything. Those are really beside the point because the essence of the contempt power is simply the deliberate flouting of a binding court order. And that is another reason why the word willful really does summarize perfectly and express perfectly the intent for purposes of contempt.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
James, I'm a little confused. The first part of your argument seemed to be that willful connotes both intentional and bad intent, and that you were going to so argue to the Supreme Court if the case goes up, so to restore the original definition of willful. And then I heard you arguing that willful shouldn't include bad intent, and we should not include it as a matter of policy.
Well, no, what I'm actually going to, let me clear that up, Senator, Madam Chair, is that what we're going to argue to the Supreme Court is that there is no separate finding required in a contempt determination of bad intent. In other words, if you find the flouting of a court order willful, that is enough. You don't also have to find something, some sort of separate subjective bad intent.
What are you going to do about the Grover case, which you say the Court of Appeals held in the face of, that incorporates bad intent within willful? Did I miss something somewhere?
Well, that was the Supreme Court. The Grover is the Supreme Court case. It basically says willful will suffice, and then by the by says willful has in it, already has in it the concept of bad intent.
Right. So now, are you going to be asking the Supreme Court to reverse Cooey on the precedent of the Grover case, thereby restoring bad intent to willful?
No, but you see, the issue in the Cooey case is really the issue of separate findings. Do you have two separate things? And in fact, you only have one, there's only one standard, and the standard is willful. And willfulness does have in it, it's when you knowingly disobey a court order, plus you do so with some deliberateness or bad intent. You know, it applies to you, and nonetheless you decide, I am going to disobey this order. That's the kind of bad intent that's really involved in contempt. But I think your question is, what we will be asking the Supreme Court to do is to affirm that the intent required for contempt is just one, is just a unitary element, a unitary mens rea is the term. It's a, it is just that it is a willful disobedience of a court order, that there's no separate finding that trial court judges are going to have to make that there's a bad intent, which of course would lead to court searching for subject, you know, some subjective bad intent. And the reason why that also is very important, Senator, is that the bad intent standard as a separate standard really gives witnesses, for example, or parties or contemnors the unilateral ability to disobey court orders and then say, well, my intent, you know, in doing so was not bad. I didn't pay that child support because I had some other obligations I thought were more important, hence I did not have a bad intent. That really, I think, begs the question of what contempt really is. It's just the disobeying of a binding court order. I don't know, if, have I answered your...
I think there's still some inconsistency there, but I suppose you're asking that the legislature clear that up, perhaps by defining through legislative history what we take willful to mean.
Well, I guess I'm asking, my comment would be I'm asking the legislature to adhere to existing law, which the existing Oregon Supreme Court law is that there's only one intent element required, and it is willfulness, which says it all, and that I think there's a danger that when you codify in a statute a dual phrase, you're going to have, and applying that phrase, you're going to have people saying, well, they've said willful and they've said bad intent. We're going to have to find separately on each one of those. And when you say bad intent, you're going to have, I think, the situation where people are looking for a subjective bad intent. And it's a redundant element because it is already incorporated in willful, and it's going to lead to... something that a dual.
That's my problem. When you say it's redundant and already incorporated and willful, then are we not creating a legislative history that willful does include bad intent, and that in order to find a willful violation, you need to also find bad intent? If that comes out of the legislature.
Well, I think you could create the legislative history by saying, in the legislative history, that willful, by willful we mean to say that it is knowingly with a bad intent, which is what the cases say. But when you actually put into the bill both phrases, you are opening it up to separate interpretations of each one of those elements. In other words, exactly what the Court of Appeals did, interpreting the phrase willful and with bad and bad intent, saying it has to be one willful, it has to be two bad intent. It may be willful, but we don't find a finding of bad of some sort of subjective bad intent, and it opens the door to abuse.
I understand that point.
Yes.
But I'm troubled by the argument that willful in and of itself includes bad intent. Because if that then becomes the definition of willful that comes out of the legislature, then to prove willfulness, you'd have to prove bad intent. And I think you're certainly not arguing that we should do that.
I think what he's saying, willful could also encompass the issue of bad intent.
Exactly.
And I think that's, but it doesn't necessarily have to encompass the bad intent.
Well, depends on what we say it means.
I guess that's all I'm saying. I think that's what I hear, what he wants and what he believes that the Grover case said. Senator Bunn.
The discussion of what the law is now isn't the law, isn't the Cooey case currently the law until the Supreme Court changes it, so that we do have... At one point you said our language would be changing the standards, but in fact our language would be upholding the standards put forward by the Court of Appeals.
Well, of course it depends, Senator, Madam Chair, it depends on what court you're looking at. There's no Supreme Court case, which is the court that counts, to be very blunt about it. There's no Oregon Supreme Court case that says there's a separate bad intent element from willfulness, that the standard is willful, and although there are, but I think it's fair to say that because of the Court of Appeals decision, which is a kind of a new development stemming from the Court of Appeals, that perhaps the law is in some flux, but I think that the safest you know, if the Supreme Court accepts review and decides to uphold the Court of Appeals and change the law, which the Oregon Supreme Court could do, then that's one thing. But currently, what the Court of Appeals has done is something new as far as the existing law.
Okay, so under the Court of Appeals action, or probably under our wording from last week, if a reporter refused to provide their source, that would be an example where if the court didn't establish bad intent, then contempt wouldn't exist.
Assuming the court had ordered the reporter to reveal the source and they declined to do so, under the Court of Appeals, a separate finding would have to be made that they had declined to answer the question willfully and that they had a quote-unquote bad intent, whatever that means.
Okay, so you're advocating we remove bad intent, the willful is the only criteria, and that would then negate what the Court of Appeals have been doing and go back to the status quo.
It would still, actually, we wouldn't negate what, it could still follow. If the Supreme Court, at least my reading is, I want to call on Ingrid and then Senator Hill has a question, as a logical non-lawyer, if we leave willful in and the Supreme Court agrees with Cooley, we would then have case law that went beyond, that would encompass what the statute is here, which means it would still be copacetic. You just have a case law that was explicitly laid out beyond what willful is and whatever else you have to include in that definition.
Okay, with that in mind, then it seems important that we make a policy decision that both criteria are met, or that either one, if someone refuses the order willfully, regardless of intent, they're guilty of contempt, or that we want both criteria. But there's definitely a policy decision to be made, and I think that we should clarify that by our outcome so that it doesn't matter what the words say, the legislative history would be clear.
Is Ingrid, you want to respond? Then I'm going to get on that center from there.
Madam Chair, I was going to raise the same point you did, which was basically that the committee needs to decide whether it wants to simply use the standard which is in place and not change it. And if that is the case, then it's probably appropriate to use the word willfully only, because the previous discussion of the committee included discussion of the Cooey case, and by putting in with bad intent in light of the Cooey case, I think the court would later read the action of the legislature as having adopted that Cooey standard without regard to the existing Supreme Court standard, should it turn out to be different, and we don't know yet. If the committee adopts the willfully language in view of the previous Supreme Court cases, then even whatever the Supreme Court does, it will decide what's encompassed in there. However, if the committee wishes to change what it perceives to be the current Supreme Court rule, obviously that can happen. I'm not sure that everyone would agree that Cooey does change that. Obviously, the other side believes that the Supreme Court has used that standard all along and will be arguing that that is the standard, a dual standard that's involved now, but that's not the position of the Attorney General's office on this issue.
Yes, I'm trying, and going back to the criminal law, aren't the most serious offenses willful and with bad intent? I mean, that's usually reserved for the most heinous crimes, isn't it? Or in tort, when you require bad intent as well?
Well, for example, punitive damages require often a deliberate disregard of societal norms or something that had this kind of a high standard, but your average criminal offense just requires that somebody intentionally have disobeyed the law. And I'd say willful, actually, in my understanding of these levels of intent, is I think willful is cranked up one above intentional. Intentional is about roughly equivalent to knowingly. So if you do something intentionally or knowingly plus a little extra, you get willfully. And that's why I think willfully by itself is really a pretty powerful word to use in the contempt statute.
And that's my recollection of the criminal law, Madam Chair. And also, is there any offense that requires and bad intent in order to have the proper mens rea?
Well, for example, aggravated murder, which carries with it a potential death penalty, does not have even have a willful or a bad intent element. It has, you have to intentionally murder somebody under aggravating circumstances. But for example, one of the cases I'm involved in is murder after escaping from an institution, and there's no special bad intent requirement in that setting, and that, you know, the most heinous crime that our society recognizes is aggravated murder.
So willful, I mean, is there a standard that's higher than willful in the criminal context?
That's a good point. You know, I don't think actually that our current criminal code uses the word willful. It uses intentionally.
Yes. So, thank you.
I wonder if it'd be helpful for us to see a standard jury instruction on willful. What is a jury told willful mean? And is that what, I have a hunch we'll find that that's what we think is appropriate, but I think it'd be useful to see that. You probably don't have that.
Well, no, because of course in a contempt you wouldn't have a jury, because it's the court that on a bench proceeding.
Yeah, but I'm thinking willful.
Under, Senator Bunn, under the current standard, yes, the court is required to apprise a contemnor, a prospective contemnor, of the right of court-appointed counsel in the event that incarceration is an ultimate remedy. So, frankly, the court does have to make that determination in the on the limited issue of court-appointed counsel.
Okay. Well, in other misdemeanor cases, you deal with the same situation where the DA decides whether or not in a particular misdemeanor incarceration is an option. And if it's not an option, you make that going in, not halfway through or when you complete the process. So it's not, I mean, it may be new in this instance, but it's not unheard of for you to deal with that, is it?
I think it can be dealt with in advance. There are charging decisions, obviously, ultimately, and renegotiations and so forth are often predicated on ultimately what the facts are believed to be going in. But if you have a hearing and you present evidence, things can change, obviously. Okay. You can get some evidence that would not have been available originally.
Well, Madam Chair, just to argue the point, you know, we could go back to where we were last week and make them prove the standard in everything so that we don't have a dual standard. But I'm not convinced we've created any significant burden compared to the benefit of protecting the individual. So I'd suggest we leave it.
Senator Shoemaker, and then we'll go.
I guess I'm not sure it makes much difference, and I want to probe on this. If you've got somebody up there and you're considering possibly a sanction of compensation, so you have clear and convincing evidence that the contempt occurred, and I think the judge can handle that. He can decide whether or not it occurred. If you're also thinking about putting the person in jail for a period of time until he obeys a court order, surely the court is going to say, give him a chance right there in the courtroom to either obey the order or not. And I mean, you're not in the question of proving it so much, you're confronting the person with it. And either you do it, or if you refuse, you go to the pokey for a while. Either case, it's going to be beyond a reasonable doubt because you're right there in the courtroom. Am I wrong? Am I missing something? Are you going to send somebody to prison based on an elaborate construct of proof about something that occurred before, when the whole premise of putting him there is that you got to stay there until you do what I tell you to do? You're surely going to confront the person with it and say, are you going to do this or aren't you going to do this?
Senator Shoemaker, Madam Chair, I think that's certainly true in instances involving civil disobedience, instances involving situations where you have clearly prospective conduct. In other words, will you or will you not in the future obey my order?
The sanction authorized for a remedial sanction, confinement for so long as the contempt continues. That's all that we're allowed to do in the remedial confinement. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be that way, doesn't it? I mean,
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I don't want to, this bill is too important for us to get lost in this particular detail.
Right.
On the other hand, I want to address Senator Bunn's concern. I think it's a legitimate one. As a private practicing attorney, I read this bill, I say, what do I want? I want this man, woman, the defendant, to do what the court said, visitation or payment of support. Do I want them to go to jail? I'll make that decision initially in the requested relief. That gives rise to what the court can do. The court can't say suddenly, you're going to go to jail, even though the party bringing the action said, I don't want that. I just want him to pay the support. But also recognize that courts tend to see these people back again. They either fail to do what they said they would do at the time of the contempt hearing after they were found in contempt, and at that point, the contemptor, the defendant, is faced with the opportunity of a threat of going to jail and an opportunity for counsel to be appointed and the limitation on the amount of incarceration. The defendant's going to know what they're faced with. The private practicing attorney has to know what they want to get done at every stage of the proceeding. So I don't see this as a major problem, your bifurcation of it. I would have preferred the lower standard, but I don't think it's that important.
Okay, we're ready to move on.
Sure.
Madam Chair, could I add a comment to something I said earlier in response to a question from Senator Shoemaker about whether this committee could change the willful, what's the definition of willful? I just want to add that there is the inherent power of the court, and I just want to remind the committee that we're not sure at what point they would draw a line and say, yes, this is what the legislature wanted, but we feel we have the power to do this. I just wanted to add that to the discussion.
Yeah, we have a little different arm's length on this particular bill than we do other bills, since we're talking about the court's power to do its own thing. A little different.
Maybe.
Little, well, okay. I think pretty clear. It's a little different. Norah, why don't we go ahead with moving through the bill as quickly as possible and catch up where we were at least. We were. We do have. Ingrid, do you want to brace? We have fleshed out the questions on corporate side of things. Where is that? With our hand to gross bill down here on sub 2, section 2 on page 1. I want to just go pick that one up.
Yes, Madam Chair. On page 1A is set forth the proposed language with respect to corporations, and that was not officially acted on by the committee at the last meeting.
Okay. We have objections to our adopting that part.
Well, Madam Chair, I thought I had moved an amendment to 1A regarding shareholders in
That rate erased. 14. I have it erased for whatever reason. You may have moved it. I'm not sure that it got that
part. No, I thought
part.
It did.
Why don't we go ahead and move it again then?
The point was that, should I raise it again or?
Well, I think I thought that was dealt with in the dash. Ingrid?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. My recollection was that it was not moved as a formal amendment, that it was among the matters discussed, but I did not record it as something that had been moved by Senator Shoemaker.
I think we had some discussion that said if you're going to bring in the shareholders on everything, that they didn't have direct managing side, and if you did have a shareholder that was a part of the direct oversight, that they would be swept in without naming them. At least I thought that's what we sort of dealt with. Sorry.
Madam Chair, and it's a little late, but for the record, I'm Nori Cross with the State Court Administrator's Office. As I recall, there was no formal amendment. It was raised. I had it penciled in my copy and crossed out because I think there was sufficient discussion to indicate that shareholders who were responsible for the act would be covered by other provisions in the amendment.
Yeah, I think we...
Okay.
With all due respect, Senator Shoemaker, we said it would be covered. Okay. Ingrid, why don't we go ahead and move through the bill then? And Nori, whoever's going to lead us.
Do you want to act on that?
Yeah, we want to act on that.
Yes, yes. I would. I thought, do we have objections to us including that amendment? Hearing none, so ordered.
I believe we are on page 4.
Right, and we took care of the Shoemaker amendments, on including alleged. We took care of the arrest warrant, page 2. We're on page, we took care of, went back to take care of clear and convincing now on page 3. We're on page, we are on page 4.
Wait a minute, how about, did we get on page 2, line 26, the confusion between the meaning of using the word incident instead of the word conduct? Did we get that?
Ingrid? Madam Chair, again, that was not a formal amendment, and the committee requested that we renew that discussion at this meeting in terms of what we decided about the current law of jeopardy, whether or not we needed to clarify that language plus the language regarding the number of incidents, and we can go into that at
okay,
this time.
Okay, that's better.
Very well. Madam Chair, we're looking at page 2, lines 23, it's subsection 5 of section 4, and the committee had inquired what current case law requires in terms of jeopardy, and both Nori Cross and Dave Hendricks and I, all of us discussed this issue and looked at some of the cases, and it appears to be the case, although it can't be said with certainty, that the court has found that jeopardy does apply in criminal contempt cases so as to bar a separate criminal action for the same conduct. That appears to be the law, although there remains some question about that because the court later spoke of criminal prosecutions in another context and decided that under the Oregon Constitution, with respect to the issue of jury trials, that it did not amount to a criminal prosecution. But assuming that the law does prohibit separate prosecutions for contempt and the same conduct as a criminal violation, this merely preserve it. The language here talks about sanctions may be imposed in addition to civil or criminal remedies that may be available. And speaking with both those other individuals, it was sort of our joint understanding that the language may be available could certainly be understood to refer to the law with respect to jeopardy, so that if, in fact, the court determines that a criminal penalty is not available under the Constitution because of jeopardy, then it is simply not available for purposes of this statute, and the statute would meet that criteria.
So we don't have to amend it.
Well, I don't think it's that simple.
Well, but the, at least you got three people who conferred who said, well, according to case law, you don't have to amend the drafting that we have here unless I read Ingrid differently.
No, that's my understanding.
Senator Bunt first.
Okay, I think that's to deal with the question of double jeopardy, but I think that on line 26, If where it says the same conduct, we change it to the same incident, at least we will make it clearer what we are dealing with in this question, because I think it could be the same type of conduct or the same individual incident, and that is not clear regardless of the other discussion, and I think we should change the word conduct to incident.
Okay. I want to hear from the people out there who've been working on this.
Madam Chair, I think I would find it helpful if Dave Hendricks could come up as well, because as I recall, we've used the term elsewhere in the bill about the same act of contempt as opposed to the term incident, which has a more sort of criminal context. And
Dave,
I think we should be consistent.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Legislative Counsel's Office. As I remember on that sentence, there was, we kind of got to the question on the same incident when the question that had come up was whether or not that sentence was intended to authorize some additional imposition of penalties where you had some prior conduct by a person where they did something and the court said, we're going to hold you in contempt and I'm going to put you in jail for 10 days, and then they went out and did it again. And the court said, oh, I'm going to take that into consideration and hit you with 30 days. I don't think that sentence was probably really ever intended to have that effect. As I remember when we were working on this in the work group, the primary thing on that was actually to say that it relates back up to the first sentence, that if, in fact, after a punitive sanction was imposed, the first sentence says that even though you've imposed a punitive one, that doesn't prevent you from going back and asking for perhaps a remedial or some civil suit, that the court should take into consideration what happened in the punitive action in imposing a sanction in the subsequent civil action. And for that reason, perhaps that's the clarification that needs to be made, that second sentence was never, I don't think, ever intended to say that you should be looking back at some prior contempt and using this sentence to say, we're going to impose a heavier sanction because that earlier case where you engaged in the same conduct and disobeyed the order. I think we should just make it clear probably that what this really means is that you should reduce or perhaps take in consideration and mitigate any sanction you impose if you've already hit them with a sanction for the same conduct previously.
I guess I'm getting a little patient, but we could sit here and redraft this every 10, sentence by sentence about what we mean.
A clear explanation that one reading coming out of this is absolutely not the intent.
Right. Well, I'm still not confused. I'm not clear what we're going to do by the last 10 minutes of discussion to fix it.
If we change the word conduct to incident or act, either one, if we change it to act, I think it makes it clear so that there are not two interpretations of it.
Okay.
I just think we have an ambiguity.
I don't have a problem dealing with it. I just want to fix it, and I want to get to the bottom of it rather than spending I want to find out how we can deal with the ambiguity. And Nori?
Madam Chair.
And David? Is act the right word?
I don't think that would be a bad change. I take a look back up the word shall take into consideration. I think that's where the ambiguity is arising out of. Unfortunately, I don't know how you fix that because it was kind of one of those.
I don't think the committee is concerned about that part.
Mm-hmm.
They want to talk about what the words same conduct mean. And I guess we need to find out whether conduct was same act or same incident. I need to hear from people who are Nori.
Madam Chair, the current law, which is ORS 33.130, uses the term the same misconduct. And by that, I am sure that we intended and we understood the current law to mean the same act, or which may be the same incident, as opposed to, say, a similar violation of the same court order. For example, repeated violations of an abuse prevention restraining order. We are talking about the one act for which somebody could be held in contempt and might also be liable to a civil suit for damages, for example.
Okay, I want to ask Carl, if we change the word conduct to act on line 26 and move on, would that confuse you?
No.
Straighten it out? Would that, I don't want to revisit this and say
Chair,
made a mistake again.
Madam Chair, I think it would clarify it because it isolates it and it refers it solely to that specific instance you're looking at rather than generally bringing in the import that you're talking about past conduct of a similar nature or something else. So it makes it clearer, I think, to interpret the statute.
Okay. So move, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Bond, Senator Hill, would you accept the deletion of the word conduct and replacement with the word act there on
line
26? Line 26,
page 2.
Are there objections to that? Thank you. Okay. Ingrid, we'll move on. We're now on page 3, are
well,
we?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Alleged on line 3.
We already took care of that.
Did we?
That's adopted. Yes.
All right, good.
We also adopted 2A, I think, Ingrid, right? Which is the rest.
I'm sure. Did we deal with a question about?
No, we haven't.
Okay, we have not adopted 2A. Then on the okay. top, that's a proposed amendment. That's the allowing the arrest warrant in the strain. We didn't have any debate about it. It's just a technical kind of piece that we need to adopt. And are there objections to adopt?
I'll move that, Madam Chair.
Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, on page 3, lines 27 through 31, did we deal with the question about whether the attorney for the third party can be appointed this special prosecutor? Did we decide that could be?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, that was approved by the committee at the last meeting.
Okay. We made no change, though.
Pardon?
We made no change, did we?
Madam Chair, the committee did make a change. And the language now says the court may appoint an attorney who is authorized to practice law in the state and who is not counsel for an interested party.
Okay.
That was the language.
That was the change. Okay, good.
We did take care of that part.
Good.
Let's move on with the big ones.
Then I think we're on page 4.
Page 4.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think I know the outcome, but I'll go ahead and make a motion on 4 and 5, if that's all right. On page 4, line 44, the six-month limit, and also on page 5, line 16, the six-month limit, I would move to amend the 6 months to 3 months.
Okay, Senator Bunn, and actually we just started getting into that when we broke up last time. Senator Bunn is asking that we change the maximum confinement from 6 months down to 3 months in both circumstances. Discussion of Senator Bunn's amendment. I guess I'm not supportive of Senator Bunn primarily because as 6 months is pretty well, I guess, developed from the federal level. At least we know we're within some realm there, possibly within. Nora, you all want to respond to that?
Madam Chair and Senator Bunn, the 6 months limit, I think, probably is derived from the federal constitutional maximum time of incarceration before a defendant is entitled to a jury trial for what is called a petty offense, and at the federal level, maybe as a right to counsel. I believe that judges are unlikely, and they certainly have not to date, been exceeding that limit because they don't want to have to go through everything you have to go through to get a jury and seat a jury, and I mean the proceedings take longer and are more expensive. My understanding from the judges with whom I've spoken about this issue is that they would oppose reducing that limit. In any case, they want the limit the same for both.
Okay. Want to hear what the committee has to say about this, or?
Madam Chair, I think we ought to stay with the 6 months. It seems to be the practice. I don't know that it's been abused. It gives the judges appropriate discretion. And it's accepted as a limit to incarceration before a right of jury arises, and I don't see any reason to change it.
Okay, Senator Bond, and then we'll call for a vote when you make your case.
I just think in light of our sentencing guideline grid and misdemeanor sentencing, that 6 months is too long for this one. There are other sanctions available.
Okay. Again, with the recommendation, with the understanding that this is a whole different piece of work than the sentencing guidelines and different kinds of sanctions. Okay, let's go ahead and call the roll on Senator Bunn's amendment to change, to reduce from 6 months to 3 months.
Senator Brockman?
No.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
No.
Senator Springer?
No.
Vice Chair Hill?
No.
Chair Cohen?
No. Motion failed. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bunn. Now, do you have another one on that?
It's on page 5.
Okay, page 5.
Line 25, a judge may at any time refer. I would propose amending to a judge shall at any time refer. Replace may with shall. And I believe there are a set of amendments that replaces may with should, but I don't see that.
Yeah, we have yet another set of amendments here. That we've gone back to that the court administrator, or whatever, I guess, the interested parties in light of the shall and the may have come up with yet another one. Dash 8, under section 10, which is referral to another judge.
At some point, I want to bring us back to page 4, the question of what is included in compensatory damages. I don't think we resolved that.
Okay, yeah, I've got a little note here in blue. This is Shoemaker. But let's take care of the shall versus may, and who's willing, who's interested in explaining this? Ingrid, do you want to do it, or Nori, whoever? Dash 8, it's a alternative to the shall.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, basically the Code of Judicial Ethics does certainly require a judge to excuse himself or herself under circumstances where they have an appearance of bias or actual bias. And my understanding is by putting it in the contempt statute, it then becomes one of those issues which may be raised as an issue on appeal, in addition to being dealt with by the court as an ethical kind of matter. This amendment, the Dash 8 amendment, basically provides for the peremptory challenge of judges, as is currently the case in criminal cases, and provides for what happens to the case if the judge is disqualified in that manner, and does not address the circumstances under which a judge should, shall, or may excuse him or herself.
So the Dash 8 amendments would leave it up to the current court practices about and the attorneys who are arguing about it, I assume, Nori?
Madam Chair, I believe that is correct. We believe that the provisions on affidavits of prejudice probably apply now. What the Dash 8 amendments would do would be to exclude the time limitation provision from contempt proceedings so that affidavits of prejudice could be filed at any time within a case when a contempt proceeding is brought and not be limited as are affidavits in other cases. And as counsel said, we did not believe it appropriate to have the ethical standard be the standard for appellate review on whether the substantive decision by the court was appropriate.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bunn.
Well, I think the Dash 8 amendments are an improvement over the original, but I also think, as was stated before, many times we are dealing with a different type of action here, and I think that the court's ability to become a bit emotionally involved in a case is probably higher in a contempt case, and therefore a little more protection is needed. And I think the shall would be better. Again, the dash 8's an improvement, but I would stay by the shall.
Okay. Further, people want to comment on this issue?
Madam Chair, can someone explain to me, without just statutory references, which we don't have, what the real difference is between the first sentence that is in the bill, if we were to put in the word shall instead of may at any time, and the sentence that is being added, that is, a judge may be disqualified as provided for in other cases under statutory references. What is the real difference between those two? Is there any?
Well, we've got a dash 8 amendment, too.
I know. The dash 8 amendment, it picks up the language that was hand-engrossed onto this edition of the bill. And what it does is deletes the line 25, 26, and the first word of 27. It deletes that is the effect of that. And I'm just wondering what the real difference is between that deleted language and this added language, which brings into the contempt proceedings the normal disqualification rules.
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, I do not believe that the language that appears in the current first sentence of Section 10 is the standard by which affidavits of prejudice are judged. The burden under the first sentence of Section 10 as it is now, and you know, if shall were the operative standard, would put the burden on the court in the first instance to make a determination without putting a burden on a party to move that the court act on an affidavit. Whereas with the affidavits of prejudice, the burden is on the party if the party believes that there may be an appearance of bias, then the party needs to make a case for that.
Okay, good. And then if the party in his or her affidavit of prejudice, can that objective be achieved or any of the grounds that are referred to, that is bias, appearance of bias, or circumstances where objectivity could reasonably be questioned, are all three of those available in an affidavit of prejudice?
I believe so, but may I please defer to Ross Shepherd?
I have to refer to
Ross.
Legislative Counsel, I think you've got to.
Good afternoon, Ross Shepherd.
Legislative Counsel, this may or may not.
Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Chapter 14 presently provides that the affiant merely state that he or she doesn't feel they can receive a fair hearing before that judge.